Chapter 146. Failures. During spring term, I experienced several failures. The first of these was mostly a failure in my own eyes. I'd expected that picking up Yiddish would be relatively easy, but nothing could have been further from the truth. In a handful of days, I had learned enough Tema to defend myself in court. But Tema was a very orderly language, and I'd already known a little bit from my studies. Perhaps, most importantly, there was a great deal of overlap between Tema and Aturin. They used the same characters for writing, and many words are related. Yiddish shared nothing with Aturin, or Shaldish, or even with Ademic for that matter. It was an irrational, tangled mess. 14 indicative verb tenses, bizarre formal inflections of address. You couldn't merely say, the Chancellor's socks. Oh no. Too simple. All ownership was oddly dual, as if the Chancellor owned his socks, but at the same time, the socks somehow also gained ownership of the Chancellor. This altered the use of both words in complex grammatical ways, as if the simple act of owning socks somehow fundamentally changed the nature of a person. So even after months of study with the Chancellor, Yiddish grammar was still a muddy jumble to me. All I had to show for my work was a messy smattering of vocabulary. My understanding of the story knots was even worse. I tried to improve matters by practicing with Diak, but he wasn't much of a teacher and admitted the only person he'd ever known who could read story knots had been his grandmother, who had died when he was very young. Second came my failure in advanced chemistry, taken under Mandrag's Giller, Anisat. While the material fascinated me, I did not get along with Anisat himself. I loved the discovery chemistry offered. I loved the thrill of experiment, the challenge of trial and retrial. I loved the puzzle of it. I also will admit a somewhat foolish fondness toward the apparatus involved. The bottles and tubes, the acids and salts, the mercury and flame. There is something primal in chemistry, something that defies explication. Either you feel it or you don't. Anisat didn't feel it. For him, chemistry was written journals and carefully penned rows of numbers. He would make me perform the same titration 4 times simply because my notation was incorrect. Why write a number down? Why should I take 10 minutes to write what my hands could finish in 5? So we argued, gently at first, but neither of us were willing to back down. As a result, barely 2 span into the term, we ended up shouting at each other in the middle of the crucible while 30 students looked on, open-mouthed with dismay. He told me to leave his class, calling me an irreverent dinnerling with no respect for authority. I called him a pompous slipstick who had missed his true calling as a counting house scribe. In all fairness, we both had some valid points. My other failure came in mathematics. After listening to Fella chatter excitedly for months about what she was learning under Master Brandur, I set out to further my number lore. Unfortunately, the loftier peaks of mathematics did not delight me. I am no poet. I do not love words for the sake of words. I love words for what they can accomplish. Similarly, I am no arithmetician. Numbers that speak only of numbers are of little interest to me. Due to my abandonment of chemistry and arithmetic, I had a great deal of free time on my hands. Some of this I spent in the fishery, making a bloodless of my own that sold practically before it hit the shelves. I also spent a fair amount of time in the archives and the Medica, doing research for an essay titled On the Non-Efficacy of Arrowroot. Arwill was skeptical, but agreed my initial research warranted attention. I also spent some of my time romantically. It was a new experience for me, as I had never caught the eye of women before. Or if I had, I hadn't known what to do with the attention. But I was older now, and wiser to some degree. And because of the stories circulating, women on both sides of the river were beginning to show an interest in me. My romances were all pleasant and brief. I cannot say why brief, except to state the obvious, that I do not have much in me that might encourage a woman to make long habit of my company. Simon, for example, had a great deal to offer. He was a gemstone in the rough, not stunning at first glance, but with a great deal of worth beneath the surface. Sim was tender, kind, and attentive as any woman could care for. He made Fella deliriously happy. Sim was a prince. By contrast, what did I have to offer? Nothing, really. Less now. I was more like a curious stone that is picked up, carried a while, and finally dropped again with the realization that for all its interesting look, it is nothing more than hardened earth. "Master Kilvin," I asked, "can you think of a metal that will stand hard use for 2,000 years and remain relatively unworn or unblemished?" The huge artificer looked up from the brass gear he was inscribing and eyed me standing in the doorway of his office.
"And what manner of project are you planning now, Relarkwolf?"
"In the last 3 months, I've been trying to create another schema as successful as my bloodless. Partly for the money, but also because I'd learned that Kilvin was much more likely to promote students with 3 or 4 impressive schema to their credit. Unfortunately, I had met with a string of failures here, too. I'd had more than 12 clever ideas, none of which had led to a finished design. Most of the ideas were struck down by Kilvin himself. 8 of my clever ideas had already been created, some of them more than 100 years ago. 5 of them, Kilvin informed me, would require the use of runes that were forbidden to Relar. 3 of them were mathematically unsound, and he quickly sketched out how they were doomed to failure, saving me dozens of hours of wasted time. One of my ideas he rejected as
utterly inappropriate for a responsible artificer.
I argued that a mechanism that would cut the time needed to reload a ballista would help ships defend against piracy. It would help defend towns against attack by Visembi raiders. But Kilvin would hear none of it. When his face began to grow dark as a storm cloud, I quickly abandoned my carefully planned arguments. In the end, only 2 of my ideas were sound, acceptable, and original. But after weeks of work, I was forced to abandon them as well, unable to get them to work. Kilvin set down his stylus and half-inscribed brass gear, turning to face me.
"I admire a student who thinks in terms of durability, Relarkwolf, but 1,000 years is a great deal to ask of stone, let alone metal, to say nothing of metal put to heavy use."
I was asking about Sasura, of course, but I hesitated to tell Kilvin the full truth. I knew all too well that the Master Artificer did not approve of artificery being used in conjunction with any sort of weapon. While he might appreciate the craftsmanship of such a sword, he would not think well of me for owning such a thing. I smiled. "It isn't for a project," I said. "I was just curious. During my travels, I was shown a sword that was quite serviceable and sharp. Despite this, there seemed to be proof that it was over 2,000 years old. Do you know of any metal that could avoid breaking for so long as that, let alone keep an edge?"
"Ah,"
Kilvin nodded, his expression not particularly surprised.
"There are such things, old magics, one could say. Or old arts now lost to us. These things are scattered through the world. Marvelous devices, mysteries. There are many reliable sources that speak of the ever-burning lamp."
He gestured with a broad hand at the hemispheres of glass laid out on his work table.
"We even possess a handful of these things here at the university."
I felt my curiosity flare up. "What sort of things?" I asked. Kilvin tugged his beard idly with one hand.
"I have a device devoid of any sigildry that seems to do nothing but consume angular momentum. I have 4 ingots of white metal, lighter than water, that I can neither melt nor mar in any way. A sheet of black glass, one side of which lacks any frictive properties at all. A piece of oddly shaped stone that maintains a temperature slightly above freezing, no matter what the heat around it."
His massive shoulders shrugged.
"These things are mysteries."
I opened my mouth, then hesitated. "Would it be inappropriate for me to ask to see some of these things?" Kilvin's smile was very white against the dark of his skin and his beard.
"It is never inappropriate to ask, Relarkwolf," he said. "A student should be curious. I would be troubled if you were indifferent to such things."
The big artificer went to his large wooden desk, so strewn with half-finished projects that the surface was barely visible. He unlocked a drawer with a key from his pocket and drew out two dull metal cubes, slightly larger than dice.
"Many of these old things we cannot fathom or make use of," he said, "but some possess remarkable utility."
He rattled the two metal cubes as if they were dice, and they rang together sweetly in his hand.
"We call these warding stones."
He bent and set them on the floor, spaced several feet apart from each other. He touched them and spoke very softly under his breath, too quietly for me to hear. I felt a subtle change in the air. At first, I thought that the room was growing colder, but then I realized the truth. I couldn't feel the radiant heat of the smoldering forge at the other end of Kilvin's office. Kilvin casually picked up the bar of iron used to stir the forge and swung it hard at my head. His gesture was so casual that it caught me completely off my guard, and I didn't even have time to cower or flinch away. The bar stopped 2 feet away from me, as if striking some unseen obstruction. There was no sound as if it had struck something, neither did it rebound in Kilvin's grip. I reached out my hand cautiously, and it butted up against nothing. It was as if the intangible air in front of me was suddenly made solid. Kilvin grinned at me.
"The warding stones are of particular use when performing dangerous experiments or testing certain equipment," he said. "They somehow produce a thaumic and kinetic barrier."
I continued to run my hand along the unseen barrier. It wasn't hard or even solid. It gave way slightly when I pushed at it and felt slippery as buttered glass. Kilvin watched me, his expression faintly amused.
"Truthfully, Rilar Quoth, until Illodin made his suggestion, I was thinking of calling your arrow-arresting device the Minor Ward."
He frowned slightly.
"Not entirely accurate, of course, but more so than Illodin's dramatic nonsense."
I leaned hard against the unseen barrier. It was solid as a stone wall. Now that I was looking more closely, I could see a subtle distortion in the air, as if I were looking through a slightly imperfect sheet of glass. "This is far superior to my arrow catch, Master Kilvin."
"True."
Kilvin gave a conciliatory nod and bent to pick up the stones, muttering again under his breath. I staggered a little when the barrier disappeared.
"But your cleverness we can repeat endlessly. This mystery we cannot."
Kilvin held up the two cubes of metal on the palm of his huge hand.
"These are useful, but never forget. Cleverness and caution profit the artificer. We do our work in the realm of the real."
He closed his fingers over the warding stones.
"Leave mystery to poets, priests, and fools."
Despite my other failures, my study with Master Illodin was progressing rather well. He claimed all I needed to improve myself as a namer was time and dedication. I gave him both, and he put them to use in odd ways. We spent hours riddling. He made me drink a pint of applejack, then read Tekum's Theophany from cover to cover. He made me wear a blindfold for 3 days straight, which didn't improve my performance in my other classes, but amused Will and Sim to no end. He encouraged me to see how long I could stay awake, and since I could afford all the coffee I liked, I managed nearly 5 days, though by the end I was rather manic and starting to hear voices. And there was the incident on the roof of the archives. Everyone has heard about that in one version or another, it seems. There was a great beast of a thunderstorm rolling in, and Illodin decided it would do me good to spend some time in the middle of it. The closer the better, he said. He knew Lauren would never allow us access to the roof of the archives, so Illodin simply stole the key. Unfortunately, that meant that when the key went tumbling off the roof, no one knew we were trapped up there. As a result, the two of us were forced to spend the entire night on the bare stone rooftop, caught in the teeth of the furious storm. It wasn't until mid-morning that the weather calmed enough for us to call down to the courtyard for help. Then, as there didn't seem to be a second key, Lauren took the straightest course and had several burly scribs simply batter down the door leading to the roof. None of this would have been a particular problem if, just as it had started to rain, Elodin hadn't insisted that we strip ourselves naked, wrap our clothes in an oilskin, and weigh them down with a brick. According to Elodin, it would help me experience the storm to the fullest degree possible. The winds were stronger than he'd expected, and they had snatched both the brick and our bundled clothes, hurling them into the sky like a handful of leaves. That was how we lost the key, you see. It had been in the pocket of Elodin's pants. Because of this, Master Lauren, Lauren's giller, Distral, and three brawny scribs found Elodin and me stark naked and wet as drowned rats on the roof of the archives. Within 15 minutes, everyone in the university had heard the story. Elodin laughed his head off at the whole thing, and though I can see the humor of it now, at the time I was far from amused. I won't burden you with the entire list of our activities. Suffice to say that Elodin went to great lengths to wake my sleeping mind. Ridiculous lengths, really. And much to my surprise, our work paid dividends. I called the name of the wind 3 times that term. The first time, I stilled the wind for the space of a long breath while standing on Stonebridge in the middle of the night. Elodin was there, coaching me. By which, I mean he was prodding me with a riding crop. I was also barefoot, and more than slightly drunk. The second time came on me unexpectedly while I was studying in tomes. I was reading a book of Yilish history when suddenly the air in the cavernous room whispered to me. I listened as Elodin had taught me, then spoke it gently. Just as gently, the hidden wind stirred into a breeze, startling the students and sending the scribs into a panic. The name faded from my mind some minutes later, but while it lasted, I held a certain knowledge that should I wish it, I could stir a storm or start a thunderclap with equal ease. The knowledge itself had to be enough for me. If I had called the wind's name strongly in the archives, Lauren would have me hung by my thumbs above the outer doors. You may not think these terribly impressive feats of naming, and I suppose you are right. But I called the wind a third time that spring, and third time pays for all.